You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Monday, April 6th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Mark Allen Derry, epidemiologist, infectious disease specialist at Health Access in New Orleans, on just about everything you would want to know about coronavirus. Meanwhile, Trump relentlessly pushing an untested miracle cure for that same virus, with over 10,000 deaths reported in the States. We still apparently have COVID-19 deaths underreported. Meanwhile, after blowing the response, White House now botching the stimulus delivery. In Chicago and Illinois, a generally massively disproportionate share of COVID-19 deaths are black folk. And Democrats dropping the ball on oversight before even picking it up. That fired Navy captain who warned about coronavirus on his ship test positive. Meanwhile, New York Amazon workers stage a walkout as it's revealed that 30 workers test positive. The Wisconsin Republican legislature has now blocked the move to postpone the primary elections in Wisconsin tomorrow. And a Friday night silent but deadly, Trump fires the inspector general who told Congress of the Ukraine whistleblower, or I should say the whistleblower, Ukraine whistleblower complaint. And in New York, it's a government takeover of the hospitals. And lastly, it's not bad enough what Trump has done to the United States in the wake of the pandemic. Now he has quashed a relief loan from the World Bank to the suffering people of Iran. Oh, happy day. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you are well. I hope you are safe. Geez, look at that. My hair is getting a little bit long, folks. Matt and Brendan are with us remotely. Hopefully Jamie maybe can call in the fun half. Got a lot to get to today. This is an interview which I'll play in a bit, an interview I did originally for Ring of Fire Radio. We have gone to all podcast in the wake of the pandemic. We just could not maintain our terrestrial radio program. And we're beginning to sort of reformulate it. And I'm trying to figure out ways in which to make it a bit of a supplement to this program. And generally what we're doing is doing shorter interviews with reporters on stories that won't last 35 minutes, that are suited more for week to week, sort of a magazine style show, if you will. And I thought I was going to interview Mark Allen Derry, who I have met before down at Netroots in New Orleans. Actually, he's an activist, also involved in radio to some extent. And I thought it was going to be a 15, 20 minute interview. It turned out to be a closer to a 40 minute interview. He's an epidemiologist. He had an incredible experience in HIV work and Ebola work. He is in New Orleans, which is a which is going through a hell right now. And he was basically willing to answer just about every question I had. And so we're going to play that today. Obviously, this is, if you were a member of Ring of Fire Radio, you would have heard this a couple of days ago. I recorded this, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday night. But really interesting interview, and we will get to that in a moment. One of the stories that's coming out, and we talked about this on Friday with Chris Hayes, is that it's quite clear that part of the reason why this whole thing is being botched, the response, is because the White House not only is incompetent, but they have seen this as an opportunity to monetize the response. They've seen this as a money-making opportunity. I mean, it sounds almost cliche, but that's what's happening. And, you know, we have a story. We talked about the supply chain that they've set up where they have done this massive airlift for the United States, presumably the Air Force or the Army, and an air bridge. And they have sourced personal protection equipment, brought it back to the States. And then instead of distributing it to where it should go, or I guess even outsourcing, like, all right, you have a distribution mechanism for hospitals, say, we're going to hire you to distribute it. Arguably more efficient than the Army trying to set up a distribution network. Arguably. But instead, what they did is they gave it to private suppliers and said, you guys resell it to hospitals. I don't even know if the resell, I don't even know if they gave it to them for free. And on top of that, they did it auction style. It wasn't just you distributed. It was like you auction this off. And so some of it actually went back overseas, because they went to the highest bidder. And now I got a story in the pack here. And I wasn't intending to read this right now, to be honest with you. So I don't have it right in front of me, but I will pull it and I'll do it later in the program. It's trying to make a broader point. A little bit disorganized on Monday. Trying to make a broader point that they're trying to monetize it. And I guess why I started with that was to make the argument that maybe there's something going on with this hydroxychloroquine that Donald Trump seems so determined to push on the United States, on doctors, on patients, despite the fact that there is not a single test, actual medical test, clinical test, as to whether this stuff works. There are anecdotes that it might, but there's also anecdotes that patients who take this on a regular basis, maybe because they have lupus, they're in the hospital with COVID-19. So the question that people are starting to ask is, like, why is the president pushing this so hard? Here he is on Saturday. This is Donald Trump on Saturday. There are apparently real side effects to hydroxychloroquine, but Donald Trump says, what have you got to lose? It's clip number two.
Because you know the answer to that question. If you do have the ventilator, you know the answer to that question. And I hate giving the answer. So I don't want to get him there. I don't want to get him there. There's a possibility. And I say it. What do you have to lose? I'll say it again. What do you have to lose? Take it. I really think they should take it. But it's their choice. And it's their doctor's choice or the doctors in the hospital. But hydroxychloroquine, try it if you'd like. The other thing, if you have a heart condition, I understand, probably you stay away from the Z-Pak. But that's an antibiotic. It can clean out the lungs. The lungs are a point of attack for this horrible virus. But when you have a ventilator, don't ask the answer because I hate it. If you have it and it's working beautifully, I don't like the answer because it's not a very high percentage. So I want to keep them out of ventilators. I want to keep them. If this drug works, it will be not a game changer, because that's not a nice enough term. It will be wonderful. It'll be so beautiful. It'll be a gift from heaven if it works. Because when people go into those ventilators, you know the answers. I know the answers. And I'm glad you don't write about it. Mike, please.
Okay. So what he's arguing is that when people get on the ventilators, anywhere from a third to two thirds, apparently, die. That when you're that bad where you need a ventilator, you have a really bad chance of survival. But he's basically pushing a drug that is completely untested. Now, that was on Saturday. Here is Wolf Blitzer interviewing Dr. Megan Ranney. She's from Brown University. This is on CNN. And she talks about, well, there's actually is a lot to lose. This is not, he's not saying, you know, hey, take one bite of your broccoli. If you don't like it, you don't have to eat anymore. But just try it. What do you got to lose? Just try it. You might like it. You might find a new food that you like. Like, he's talking to the American public like they're a 7-year-old or 6-year-old kid. But apparently there are things to lose. Clip number 4.
He's certainly not a doctor, but Dr. Ranney, you are a doctor. You're an emergency room physician. What do you think?
So I'm an emergency room physician. I am also a researcher and scientist myself. President Trump repeatedly said that doing proper tests would take years. It will not take years to test this drug. There are so many COVID-19 positive patients in this country right now. There are so many trials that are already ongoing. I would expect that with the funding that's been provided by NIH and by private companies, we're going to have results within a month or two about this medication. And there's a lot to lose. As Dr. Harris said, this medication has major side effects, including paranoia, hallucinations, suicidal thoughts, suppression of your blood counts so that you become more susceptible to infections. It can cause severe cardiac arrhythmias that can even cause death. Now, these are not common side effects, but they are common enough that this should not just be taken willy-nilly. It is not like water. It is not harmless, and it may have major side effects. Now, for the right patient in the context of a study, absolutely, this may be indicated, and we don't have full knowledge yet. But I don't want Americans across the country to think that if they come down with a slightest sniffle, that COVID, that taking hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine is the solution for them. It makes me nervous, as Dr. Harris said, on behalf of the patients that really need it, but also on behalf of the patients who could be severely harmed if they take this and it doesn't help, but actually hurts them.
So there are tests ongoing. It could turn out, he could be right. He could be offering anything. But he clearly has some type of deep, deep investment in this medication. Axios reports that there was a big fight on the coronavirus task force on Saturday following, I would imagine, or maybe leading up to the press conference that day. The fight was between Peter Navarro and Anthony Fauci. Now, Peter Navarro is the economist who is been advising Donald Trump on the trade wars, which have been not going well. So I'm not sure I would take his advice on the economy, but apparently he considers himself a social scientist and has a folder full of anecdotes that it works. And he got back into, he got into a fight with Fauci about it because Fauci was basically saying there's no tests. There's no peer-reviewed results. There's no clinical studies that you can cite because they don't exist. They're ongoing, but they have not come back with any results. And apparently, Fauci just said, like, all you have is anecdotes. And Navarro said, I have them in a folder. They're science. And then he accused Fauci of objecting to the travel restrictions on China. And apparently Fauci had no idea what he was talking about because Fauci supported them. Here, this all, this sort of, I guess, three-act play ends on Sunday when one of the reporters in the press pool wants to ask Fauci, what's your opinion about this hydroxychloroquine, as Donald Trump calls it? And Donald Trump does not want Fauci to respond.
Also weigh in on this issue of hydroxychloroquine. What do you think about this? And what, is the medical evidence?
Can I answer that question?
Yeah. Well,
maybe
15, the doctor.
15 times. You don't have to ask.
He's your medical expert, correct?
He's answered that question 15 times.
Dr. Fauci, why are you not...
Yeah, and now what's amazing here is that none of the reporters followed up on that. Trump starts to walk threateningly towards the reporter, like he's just going to come over and get right into his face. And then none of the reporters follow up on that. Why should we hear from the top medical expert who is leading this fight about coronavirus? Why should we hear from him as to the efficacy of this drug? It's, I mean, this is insanity. And the idea that Democrats at this point, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, are their oversight is just going to be more like going forward, as opposed to get a sense of exactly how things have been botched up and why. I don't know how you can fix it going forward if you don't understand why this has been such a disastrous response over the past 2 months. But somebody should look into who has holdings in the production of this drug. Maybe Donald Trump is just really, really beguiled by this drug. Or maybe, like everything else that has taken place in this in the course of this, there is somebody who has Donald Trump's ear who stands to make a lot of money from this drug. It's nuts. All right, running a little late here, but that's all right. We got a pre-record. We will get to that. I'm going to do the plugs and notices in a minute, but I should just tell you that Harry's, the razor company, they know sometimes it's better to stay inside, and that's why they ship directly to you. You can join the 10 million people who have tried Harry's and claim your special trial offer by going to harrys.com/majority report. Now, as you can see, I have held off shaving for a couple of weeks now because I'm not doing any television, and I figure, why not? I also have not cut my hair because not going to let my daughter do it. But when I shave with Harry's. And I know that when I ultimately shave this beard off, because Harry's razors are the sharpest I've found. Now, that's not my favorite thing about Harry's. My favorite thing is about the narrow shave head And just the look of the razor. I like the handle. Doesn't make me feel like I'm, I don't know, some type of paramilitary guy. It's just, it's a very simple, stylish razor handle. Harry's is a return to the essential quality, durable blades at a fair price and just $2 a blade. They've cut out the middleman. They're manufacturing their blades in a German blade factory that's been honing precision blades for a century. So you get incredibly high quality blades at factory direct prices. And blade refills are delivered directly to your door on your schedule, with or without a subscription. Harry's has a 100% quality guarantee. If you don't love your shave, they give you a full refund. Plus, 1% of proceeds are set aside for nonprofit organizations. Listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, like I mentioned earlier, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/majority report. Start shaving better today. Also, online shopping is supposed to be easy. So why is it hard to find coupon codes that actually work? They used to work. I used to search coupon codes and they used to work. And now they all just got all those sites. The codes either are dead or they just send you right to the, they just link you to the actual site. Well, thanks to Honey, it doesn't have to be like that. Honey is a free online shopping tool that automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart. Yes, you heard me. It's free. Imagine you're shopping on one of your favorite sites, Target, Best Buy. What is that? Newegg, somebody suggested to me. When you check out, this little box drops down and all you have to do is click Apply Coupons. Wait a few seconds for it to scan every promo code on the internet and then watch the prices drop. Since Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, adding more each day, you're not limited with where you can shop. This is how I shop now. I used to sit Myla down. I said, look, you're not ordering anything without searching for a code. And now she doesn't have to do that. And now it's just one less thing that I have to nag her about. Not using Honey is literally passing up free money. It's free to use and installs in just 2 clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. All right. And now it's time, folks, for plugs and notices. This is where we try and put helpful links for you if you are looking for just about anything that to deal with this, both the health and economic crisis that we are going through and will be going through for a while, I anticipate. You can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, put plugs and notices in the subject line, and I will get to it. First up, we have healthreformbeyondthebasics.org. They have a COVID-19 fact sheet that helps you, if you've lost your job, figure out where you're best suited to find maybe some healthcare coverage. Also, a link for a GoFundMe for Ayuda Matua MKE. It's an informal group that grew up on the south side of Milwaukee. 7 Latinx artists, creatives came together to start feeding families in their neighborhood. You can help 280 families per week and growing in that area. Make sure that they have food security. Listener Matt writes in, I've been volunteering with New England PPE. It's a grassroots group of Providence artists and designers starting to make masks and face shields for folks in southern New England. If you're a medical worker and are looking for PPE right now, contact us via our site at newenglandppe.com. So it's newenglandppe.com/contact. And listeners can go check out what they're doing or donate to the GoFundMe. at newenglandppe.com. As always, all these links will be in the podcast description and the video description on YouTube. Matt also sells art at mattracyart.com. Nate writes in, anybody looking for a good alternative to Amazon, try newegg.com. Prices are comparable or often better. They sell all sorts of stuff. The Mad Mailman wants to plug Susan Rogers. She's custom making masks for people, $7 in each. For every mask she sells, she's donating one. She sells them from her Facebook group called Shop Lidora Chatter. Lidora Chatter. Aziz writes, Inclusive Action for the City is raising money for an emergency relief fund for street vendors in L.A., which food vendors will receive $400 of direct cash relief. Many of these people are getting no assistance from the state. You can go to inclusiveaction.org, COVID-19 response. From that link, you can either donate through the United Way Pandemic Relief Fund or the GoFundMe Emergency Fund. There's also a mutual aid network for local Asian American communities in LA County who are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. That link will also be posted in the descriptions. Hi, Sam. I'm a licensed behavior therapist and social skills coach. I work with children, teens, and young adults with autism. I can also provide coaching and support for parents and families as well. Licensed in Pennsylvania, have all my clearances and no NPI reports regarding any malfeasance. I'm now set up for clients on Doxy. I'm happy to help a coach or provide support for parents with children on the spectrum. This is from Heidi Maureen, and you can reach her at hmm1713@gmail.com. Costume designers in Hollywood are making masks for medical workers. You can go to mask-crusaders.com or instagram.com/maskcrusaders. If you are looking for masks, if you know medical workers that are looking for them, that's from Bill. And Nikon is offering free photo classes in April, nikonevents.com. That's our plugs and notices. All the links will be in this description in YouTube. Check it out. Pass it around if you want. They will live there. And you can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And we will get it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, this pre-recorded interview I did with Mark Allen Derry from Health Access in New Orleans. So, Mark Allen, let's just start with what you've been doing as an infectious disease physician and the chief innovation officer for Access Health Louisiana. What kind of stuff do you generally do in your capacity?
Pre-COVID-19?
Pre-COVID-19, just so folks get a sense of how people have gotten sort of drafted into this. And then, of course, there's a little bit of a coincidence in that New Orleans, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, but is one of the, I guess, epicenters in the country, or at least a burgeoning one. But just give us a sense of what, normal life looks like for you.
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Tulane, and so I teach regularly at Tulane, and I teach courses in infectious diseases. I at Access Health, where I serve as chief innovation officer and medical director of infectious diseases, we're the largest Medicaid clinics in the state of Louisiana. So we have 36 clinics, and I have one clinic that's just dedicated to treatment of people living with HIV and then hepatitis C as well. We're able to cure hepatitis C now. Prior to COVID-19, that was the big news here in Louisiana, is that we have 5 years of free Hep C medications that we are able to use for people living with Hep C, and we're able to get them cured in about 12 weeks. And then, of course, I also help out, and I see patients at the hospitals in and around the city. So that's usually kind of what my daily life is usually like, doing infectious diseases here. And then whenever there's, you know, some sort of outbreak that happens abroad or disasters, I usually get drafted over in, to respond to infectious complications or disasters. You know, Haiti, I was in Haiti within 3 days after the earthquake and helped to erect and run the American hospital there. And then just most recently, I worked with the WHO, the World Health Organization in Sierra Leone and Freetown, where I was part of the Ebola response and was there for about 4 months, kind of on the street, if you will, doing clinical epidemiology. And essentially what I was doing was contact tracing. So I was finding active cases of Ebola. I'd get folks kind of out of their houses or out of their compounds, put them into an Ebola treatment center, and then start hunting down their contacts and then trying to find them before they developed Ebola so that we can start treatment for them, which is really just fluids, but even just isolating them so that they're not able to transmit to other folks. So it's kind of like the life of an infectious diseases doctor, especially here in New Orleans.
And I want to ask you about that, but just so that we're clear, you both treat patients, and as opposed to, you know, what doctors, you know, that's what doctors generally do, is they treat patients. But you also have built into sort of your treatment is a health policy dimension, and you know, you're actually fighting the transmission of a disease. I mean, so you have sort of like two separate spheres on some ways that you're a doctor.
Sure. I would refer to myself as an epidemiologist. So I have I have a master's in biostatistics, so tracking diseases, especially HIV, on a normal kind of pre-C19 or COVID-19. I just abbreviated C19. Pre-C19, I do a lot of HIV epidemiology as well, and manage you know, several large federal grants, both to treat people living with HIV, as well as to educate and do you know, kind of disease tracking epidemiology of HIV in the state of Louisiana, and particularly in New Orleans.
All right. So give us a sense. I mean, I've got a lot of questions to ask you, obviously.
Sure.
But give us, but let's just start with, you know, so that's your sort of normal life. When this hits in New Orleans, I mean, suddenly the places where you're dealing with, your work has sort of basically invaded on some level your personal daily life in some weird way, right? I mean, you're out there, your supermarket is no longer your supermarket. It is it becomes part of what you are dealing with as an epidemiologist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a large part is, thankfully, a large part of the contemporary HIV management right now is almost doing it on its own. So I was able to really quickly kind of take my attention off of my folks living with HIV, and the same thing with hepatitis C, and then just start focusing on seeing people with symptoms of or that look like COVID-19. And I think I estimated, I mean, we immediately shifted into telemedicine. So that was a huge, relief for us, is that we were able to do either telephonic calls if people weren't able to do telemedicine. Because the telemedicine, we didn't have the equipment up and running, I was able to just use FaceTime. And fortunately, the feds have kind of relaxed HIPAA, if you will, for right now in this state of emergency. And HIPAA is the Medical Privacy Act that you're probably aware of. And so we were able to immediately start seeing folks either through telephone or televideo or telemedicine conferencing. And it happened almost overnight, where we were seeing 60 to 70 to 80 patients a day, just as we were beginning to understand what this pathogen was looking like in the initial days. Then ultimately what happened was that we finally got some of that, the testing. New Orleans was one of the federal testing sites. They had three kind of pilot testing sites sites that they set up around the country, and New Orleans was one of those testing sites, and I served as medical director at the testing site that was pretty much in downtown New Orleans. And so, like, you're right. So one day, Mahalia Jackson Theater is a theater, and it's a, you know, a world-known theater, and then the next day it's become, you know, part of a testing site, and it's been the testing site, at least one of them, here in New Orleans for the past 10 days.
Okay, and so, and that work you're doing in terms of telemedicine is both to treat the those people who may or may not have it, and also to track it, to contain it. How did that that element of your epidemiologist element, I guess, how did that change over the past couple of weeks?
So, I mean, again, all of the above, what you were just saying just now. And let me add another level of context here, is that it's tapering off in terms of flu season as we record this today on April 1st. Although just this morning, the CDC said there was just a little uptick of flu. But we have had the tail end of flu season, and boy, oh boy, is it allergy season here in New Orleans. So when I was doing the majority of these calls, when we were shifting into telehealth or telemedicine, it was largely trying to determine, because if you look at those three illnesses, seasonal allergies, influenza, and COVID-19, the Venn diagrams overlap pretty well. So it was just kind of hard to tease out who was an allergy, who was who maybe flu, or who may have the COVID-19 virus. And 3 weeks ago, it's almost humorous to think that we were able to tell it apart. And to a large degree, we were able to, and for whoever I couldn't tell, that's who we recommended to get testing. Now we are at a point now that it's so diffused through our community, so it's so distributed through the community, that now we all operate, or at least physicians, certainly the infectious disease doctors, all operate from the perspective that everybody at this point is positive, and we need to operate from the perspective that everyone is positive. And in fact, about an hour and a half ago, the public health service here in New Orleans that is in charge of texting us updates even actually put out an update to the public that said, pretty much at this point, assume that everybody is positive. And so that's certainly an interesting way of looking at things. And if you want, we could talk a little bit more about what the future of testing is going to look like, because it's going to shift away from looking at testing virus, and it's going to shift directly into checking for antibodies, because screening for antibodies is so incredibly important right now. We missed the boat with testing. I mean, that's just, we should have been testing eight weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. We should have been testing in late January. And had we done that then, we could have had a handle on. Let me give you an example. Had we done it, at one time, the CDC knew everybody who was positive for HIV, or at least they had an idea in the early 80s who was positive for HIV, because the contact tracing was so easy to do, because, you know, you had one person who said, oh yeah, I had contact with, you know, two other people. You went to those two other people, you checked them, and it was, you know, it was very easy to find where HIV and how it was transmitting. In fact, that's where the whole concept of ground zero came from, this whole idea of patient zero, because they were using circles to identify who was in fact, you know, who had HIV. But unfortunately, at the time, they chose not to do anything about it, and they allowed HIV to continue to percolate through the communities and through society. Now, it's a genie that we can't put back in the bottle. And the same thing with respect to how we missed the boat with testing 8 weeks ago, and we could have done something. And I usually use South Korea as being the kind of the paragon, if you will, of the best example of who did incredibly aggressive testing. You know, like I was saying, you know, when we did our testing, I was so proud. Over a course of 3 days, we tested 450 people. And while I'm not going to pat myself on the back for it, because I will remember that same weekend, South Korea tested 60,000 people. Yeah. So the testing capacity has been so so difficult, and we just didn't have the public health infrastructure to support it, that at this point, testing directly for virus is probably a little less relevant, and I'm strongly making the argument for antibody testing. And I'll tell you why. One is that you're going to be able to clear doctors and frontline people, nurses, and if they've already been positive, they will work with less anxiety.
Right, let me just start, Mark Allen, let me just stop you right here, just so that people can understand the distinction. When you're testing for the virus, you are the value of that is to know who has it, to know who might else have it, quarantine those people to prevent them from giving it to other people. Once the cows have left the barn, as it were, now you're
That's
out
exactly
in
right.
the pasture. Now you're in the pasture trying to find out which one of these cows can actually mingle with the other cows without getting it, so that they can actually
exactly
function
right.
in a different way. Okay, and that's what the antibodies
right.
indicate that you've that's had the, it in the past. Okay.
Right, that indicates that you've had it in the past. So now we'd be able to start clearing workers, you know, to be able to go back to work. I mean, this is one way that we'd be able to kind of move forward with the economy in some way or another. But again, healthcare workers will know if they're positive, then they're going to be working on the front line and with a level of comfort without the fear of thinking that they may be able to bring, you know, the virus home to infect, you know, family members and loved ones.
Now, at one point you said, you know, we want to get a sense of what this pathogen looks like. And I'd imagine what that, you know, what that entails is a whole series of not just what it does to the body and how it travels through the body, but how it gets passed on from person to person. So let's just work a little bit backwards. If I have antibodies, can I get reinfected? Do we know that having gotten this specific COVID-19 or other coronaviruses may or may not protect me from getting it again? Do we know that yet?
We don't know for 100%. So there was an assumption being made of which you keyed right into, is that we have to make the assumption that if you have these antibodies, that then the assumption being is that reinfection is not possible. Now, let me tell you what the studies actually show. The studies do show that in some folks that are outliers or some folks that are pretty rare, that there does seem to be evidence of reinfection. But when we're looking at a country like China right now, who's had, you know, of course they had something like 80,000 cases or so, what we aren't seeing at this point is reinfection. There are new infections in China right now, but those are mostly coming in from outside. So I think the answer to reinfection, I think I'm pretty comfortable saying that the answer is pretty much no, but there is one technical element to it, and that is that there's a couple of strains of this C19 virus, this COVID-19. One is called an L strain, the other one is called an S strain. The S strain is mostly limited to Asia, particularly China, whereas the L strain is the one that's circulating through Australia, North America, and Europe. So it's unlikely that the strains are going to, you know, somebody would get, if they were infected with an L strain, would then be exposed to an S strain, because again, it is somewhat limited to China. But theoretically reinfection is possible. We're operating from the assumption that it's not at this point. So antibodies would mean that you are likely to not get it again.
Okay. And how hard is it to measure antibodies? Like, I mean, is the testing that is involved in knowing whether the virus is present easier or harder than testing for antibodies, both in terms of application, in terms of turnaround, in terms of production of those tests?
Sure. So again, another great, somewhat technical, I'm going to try to answer as easy as possible. The way that we used to test up until a couple, you know, a week ago or whatever, is the nasal pharyngeal swab, where they kind of put a swab directly kind of right to the back of your nose, and they swab it around. Most people may have had that when they got tested for the flu. Those results have been taken 7, 10. I got a person who I tested on the 15th or the 16th, and the results came back like on the 29th. I mean, ridiculous. I mean, these are backlogged. You know, these labs weren't ready for this. Whereas the new tests, both the direct PCR test, and or the which test for the virus, or these new antibodies. The these new tests, the PCR test that tests directly for the virus, takes about 5 to 15 minutes results, and then the new antibody test, which is like a pinprick, kind of like you were checking your blood sugar, if you will. That test also takes 15 minutes, and then that would tell you whether or not you have antibodies.
Wow. Okay. So that is, if we can widely distribute that, that is going to be huge.
It's going to be a game changer. be a game changer. And the FDA just approved both of those tests just this past weekend. So they're ready. Okay. So now there's manufacturers that are going to be able to hopefully scale those up and get them to market.
What I mean, do you have a sense of, based upon your past experience with these type of things? Like, you know, what is that timeline? Are we talking 12 weeks? Are we talking 12 days?
We immediately put together a plan over the weekend, reached out to the CEO of our clinic system. And what we were told back was that they are looking at states like yours, New York, possibly for initial distribution for antibodies. They're looking at California. And then they're going to start looking at needs of cities after that. So I don't think that we're going to be, that New Orleans particularly is going to be immediate with respect to being able to get some of those tests, but I think that it will probably come down the line.
But like, how long does it take to produce that? I mean, is that something that,
I have no idea. I would think, they were just approved. So, you know, I don't know where they're made. I don't know how they're made. I don't know. You know, I wish I knew that information. I don't.
And just one more question on the testing. And then I just want to ask you about transmission.
Okay.
On the testing side, do you have any insight? I mean, and again, this might be outside of your portfolio, but do you have any insight as to that sort of process of the World Health Organization had testing that, you know, South Korea obviously had the, you know, a formula for testing and why is it typical that we would not adopt an international patent for testing, standard for testing? I mean, aside from the fact that we started so late in attempting to get testing, and aside from the fact that the CDC made a test that was a disaster, apparently, the first round they sent it out, was that process typical? Or, are we in a sort of a situation where we just haven't been before? So, you know, there is no typical.
So I understand the your question, and I try to talk about this whenever possible. So I'm so glad you asked it. I think one, it's an atypical situation, but so Germany made the test. They gave it to the WHO. The WHO freely distributed this test around the world. The U.S. said no. Now I have been like, I would love for an investigative reporter to find out who it was that said no and why they decided to either privatize that or to possibly contract it out to somebody else. I don't know. Some of the articles that I read kind of point to the person who runs the CDC right now, his name just escaped me as I reached for it. This is a person who has not ever run a federal entity before. And I think even himself, he is a person who in the 80s had kind of been sanctioned by a medical board because he was claimed to have some sort of cure for HIV.
Redfield came from, I think, Mike Pence, essentially. He's a Mike Pence
there
guy.
There you go. Yeah, I think he has a lot of religious.
Yes.
I don't want to call him a zealot, but that seems to be the only word that comes to mind.
Well, relative anyway, to his perspective, if I remember correctly, his perspective on AIDS and what he would write about it at certain times relative to, mixing sort of the morality that he perceived, et cetera, I would say that's a safe assumption, but go ahead.
Good. So you're right. So they did not take that WHO test, and you will hear people say, well, it wouldn't have passed FDA standards. I don't know if that's the case or not, because the tests that we're producing now, let's say on today, April 1st, compared to tests that were being made and utilized on January 25th, like, I don't understand how, you know, an FDA approval process really, you know, takes any sort of precedent, that we were talking about a public health emergency, and they knew it was a public health emergency. They were very clear about that, and largely because we see evidence of that because of the fact that we saw senators who started to dump their stock, and I use that as a surrogate for that
right.
That on the federal level, people knew what was going on, and there's even tape of Senator Burr kind of speaking at a luncheon in which he was even comparing this novel coronavirus to the flu of 1918, saying that there was equal infectivity as well, or transmission as well as mortality rates. So to my
Senator Loeffler, just to add, today it was revealed Senator Loeffler from Georgia not only sold a bunch of her stocks, she bought stocks of companies that produced personal protection equipment. I mean, she knew what was going on. She saw where this was going.
Right.
Yes, there's absolutely total awareness, I think, at that level, anyway.
Her husband, I think, is he president of like the stock exchange too?
Yeah,
I
he's mean, the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. Yes. So, I mean,
so,
a lot of people made some money off of that. But,
they knew. But they opted to not do the test. And like, just to wrap up this, they knew, they opted to not go with the test. And like you said, the CDC actually had released the test. And I remember I was lecturing at Tulane at medical students about this. And I was, you know, bragging about the CDC because, of course, I, you know, look to the CDC. I'm an infectious disease doctor. I have many colleagues that work there. And as I was talking about the fact that we were in the need of a test, and this was in, you know, probably mid-February, I was giving this lecture. As I was talking, a medical student raised his hand and he had his phone out, and he's like, "Dr. Jerry, just wanted to share with you that we're getting a text message right now that the CDC is recalling all of their tests because it performed so poorly."
Wow.
And that put us back even a couple more weeks. So the testing has been just an unmitigated disaster.
Okay, so let me ask you this in terms of transmission. I think everyone is quite clear now that it is, you know, that it's droplets, that getting the droplets on your hand, touching your face, that is the main way of transmission. I have heard various things. Go ahead, please.
That's not. No. I'm sorry. I just want to correct that.
Please.
And you know, forgive me for interrupting. So the main way of transmission is not by touching your face. The main way of transmission is by breathing in that droplet. So it's by breathing it in. And to be perfectly honest with you, and I don't want to throw a curveball here, but there actually hasn't really been any evidence. Previous coronaviruses have been able to get in through maybe kind of close to the eyes and stuff, but there has been no evidence of whether or not touching your face is really a thing or not. But because everybody's washing their hands and they're not touching their face, listen, I've waited 20 years in my career as a germaphobe and infectious disease doctor to not have to be able to shake hands, to do elbow bumps or what have you. So I'm happy that people are obsessive about washing their hands. But I just wanted to say the main way is by literally breathing the air that somebody else just either sneezed or coughed or breathed out through a droplet where the virus is living on top of that or living within that droplet. You breathe it in, it gets into your lungs, and that's when it sets up its either pneumonia or other complications.
So the primary thing that you would tell people is stay 6 feet away. And
absolutely.
And then it could be that guy sneezes, it lands on your hand, you stick your hand in your mouth, that type of thing.
That's exactly right. Yes. Or you rub your nose or something like that. But again, it's mostly been shown to be mostly kind of breathing in the air that where there was a droplet. That's mostly.
What about the, we have seen reports that it lives in the air.
that it can be aerialized and can exist in the air. I saw reports that it was alive on surfaces in one of the cruise ships for 17 days. I don't know what exactly surface it was talking about. I've heard reports that it can stay on cardboard for 24 hours and that it could be on plastic for up to 6 or 7 days. What of that? What do we know about transmission of that? How worried should we be when she get a package? Or if I go to the supermarket and I buy a carton of milk and I buy produce and I buy produce that's in a plastic wrapper?
Right. So let me just say that. So regarding the first question, so whether or not it could be aerosolized or not, I think the answer is almost yes. And I feel like we're leaning more into that this possibly could be airborne. And the difference between a droplet and aerosolization / airborne is that the virus would be able to travel further without, because when it's on a droplet, when it's on a droplet, I'm going to, just for lack of better words, I'm going to just be slightly crude here and just say that, like, that's the spit, let's say, that you would, as you're talking to somebody, you invertedly, you know, some of the saliva leaves your mouth, right? That droplet is subject to gravity. And so it drops to the ground within usually 3 feet. The reason why we say 6 feet is that in medicine, we always tend to overcompensate. When something could be aerosolized, that means that that it can travel further and maybe even subject to some of the winds or gusts. Now, I'm not saying that we're there yet, but it feels like we're kind of starting to move in that direction. And I have read some reports. Some people are saying that it's aerosolized. Just this morning, I know that the official kind of, like, you know, folks, you know, the federal people that I look to for guidance on this are still saying droplets with possible aerosolization, but that may be moving into airborne. But I would say droplets for right now with some aerosolization. Now, in terms of produce and stuff, yes, there's no question. The New England Journal 2 weeks ago came out with an article looking at other coronaviruses and seeing what other coronaviruses do. And like you said, you explained very nicely, cardboard for 24 hours, plastic surfaces for 4 days. In fact, I just created a slide a minute ago, and if I had my computer open, I'd be able to read it to you. But it does live on surfaces. I don't clean products that come back from the supermarket. Maybe I should, it hadn't, you know, I actually heard you talking about, you know, on your show not too long ago about cardboard boxes, right? Packages. I know my mother-in-law leaves them outside for 24 hours before she brings them in. My mother-in-law has been really good with, like, kind of cleaning everything down. That would not necessarily be, you know, that seems fine to do, at our house. My wife and I, you know, me being a germaphobe and infectious disease doctor, we don't do that. And, so it's not a bad idea to do it. It just never occurred to us to actually go ahead and do that.
It doesn't cost anything to do it. Let's put it that way. And,
absolutely. It's not harmful at all to do. And I see why people do it. I absolutely see why.
So getting back to the droplets and the potential that it's aerolized, which would mean that it has the ability to travel more than 6 feet, because you're not tied to a droplet and someone sneeze, then what we're looking at is probably headed towards a situation where when you go out in public, you wear a mask.
So that's a good question, and let's address that. And but also while that is an issue, the likelihood of transmission that way is so much more smaller than even a bigger issue. And that bigger issue is that people are asymptomatic and transmitting virus. That's a much bigger issue to be concerned about. And I'll get back to that in a second, because today Iceland just released a study, the government, and they showed that 50% of the people they tested were 100% asymptomatic. In other words, they tested and tested positive, were 100% asymptomatic. So those individuals are the ones that are shedding virus, and those are the ones that are particularly problematic. But, and we can get to that in a second, but getting to the mask thing, because it's such an important point. There's two types of masks. There's masks that keep virus in, right? Those are like the surgical masks. And then there's masks that keep virus out, and those are like the N95 N95 masks. Those are the masks that I wear when I'm in the hospital. Now, those surgical masks, they were essentially invented for a surgeon. So when a surgeon, when she's looking over her operative field, she doesn't accidentally, as she's talking, kind of drop saliva from her mouth or sneeze or cough into her operative field. So that is what keeps the virus, you know, from circulating outward. And so let me give you a quick little measurement here. So the virus itself is 0.1 micron. A thread of hair, or just one human hair, is 75 microns, just to give you a context to what 0.1 micron looks like. A piece of hair is 75 microns. So when you look at the stitching of a mask, a surgical mask, it's like trying to hold flooding waters back using a chain link fence. So for somebody who's trying to avoid getting the virus, an N95 is the one that you should be wearing. But those really should be reserved for medical experts. They're hard to wear. You have to be fitted for them. Those are the ones that are called respirators, not to be confused with ventilators. There are a lot of people who confuse the two things.
Right.
Ventilators are breathing machines, and respirators are the masks that people wear. So when you usually start at a hospital, the first thing that they do is as they go through the orientation process is they fit you with an N95 so you know what size mask that you wear. And those masks really can be worn for 15 or 20 minutes because it's hard to breathe in them. Now, for the surgical mask, the people who are out and about with the surgical mask, where did that come from? Well, that started with the SARS epidemic in 2002, 2003. And that's largely because the Asian culture, there's such an element of consideration within the Asian culture. The reason why they wear the mask is so that somebody who's sick is not going to transmit their cough or their sneeze or their virus to somebody else. And that's the purpose for those masks. They're not really meant for people to prevent getting sick from it. Does that make sense? So if you're
sick, in Czechoslovakia, they would say, they said, my mask is to protect you. Your mask is to protect me, essentially.
That's exactly right. But I will say this, and then here's the caveat. Boy, oh boy, the mask thing is changing like day to day because, you know, last week, I don't know where it's evolving daily. So there was a time where I was emphatic that masks should only be worn by healthcare workers or if you're sick and you don't want to get somebody else sick. But I almost feel as though that may be shifting and that I wouldn't be surprised if the CDC at one point does make a recommendation for everybody.
And that's because of what came out of Iceland, where 50% of the people are asymptomatic, and you just don't know who it is. So the easy thing is everybody wears masks. And if everybody wears masks, then we have, at the very least, 100% of the people who have it and aren't and don't know it have at least masks. And when they sneeze, they're not going to get it on you.
That's exactly right. That is another way that we would potentially be able to, quote unquote, flatten the curve. So again, you have to think about masks from being two ways. Masks that keep the virus in. So in other words, those masks that would be the surgical masks or the bandanas or whatever, and the masks that keep viruses out. So what we're talking about here, of course, is that if the CDC does recommend, right, it's so that people are keeping the mask in. So it's just, I like to make that clear because people feel as though I'm protecting myself. And really, if everybody walks around with masks, which I wouldn't necessarily oppose, it would probably very quickly help reduce and flatten the curve even quicker because, just like you said, it's the asymptomatic people that are very likely to be transmitting the virus more than anybody else.
Okay, so lastly, let me ask you this question. How long do you shed? In other words, if I'm asymptomatic, how long do I have the virus? I mean, and is there a way to even measure it? Because if I'm asymptomatic, like how do I know, how long does it last in the body, even if I have no symptoms?
So what's frustrating is that it's different for every person. And so the New England Journal did a really great study right at the very beginning of this. And they kind of did a case study of this woman whose parents visited her from Wuhan. I think she lived in Beijing. She was a business person. She went to Germany right after her parents visited. And this is before Wuhan really kind of exploded. She went to Germany and attended a business meeting for 2 days. And she transmitted her virus. She infected two colleagues of hers for which she had some sporadic contact with. So we'll talk about index case number one is how they referred to him in the study. The patient was asymptomatic for a couple days and then became symptomatic. He had a 24-hour with a cold and a flu-like illness. He got better right away. That was at that point they realized that he probably had COVID. They tested him while he was sick. He tested positive, and then they tested him several days out until he tested negative. And it was something like 9 days after he actually had the initial contact with the person, that the businesswoman that came in from China. So, and we have seen that viral shedding can occur for a long period of time, probably a few days to possibly a couple weeks. I've heard numbers that have even extended beyond that, but most of the numbers, essentially, we don't know. And the other thing is that we can't test everybody because we don't have enough tests. So it would be one of these things that they are doing as an experiment or scientific experiment or observational trial in which they would just be testing people who are positive, and they would just keep testing them repeatedly until they tested negative. And so viral shedding is a huge problem, especially amongst people who are asymptomatic. And so we don't know how long they shed for. That's why initially when we were talking about antibody testing, I said that we're making an assumption that there's no viral shedding at the point of antibodies, but that's just really an operating assumption.
Right.
If there was another physician or an infectious disease doctor that was sitting in this conversation, they would have every right to interrupt me and say, well, that's just an assumption. We don't know that for sure. And they are correct. We don't know that for sure. But, there are several things. We have to have people at one point go back to work. You can't isolate people for long. And we just don't know when the viral shedding stops. But I think it's a fair assumption that at the point that you start making antibodies, especially the long-term antibodies called IgG, that you probably at that point are not shedding virus anymore. But again, that's just another one of those questions that are going to probably be answered pretty soon.
Well, let me ask you this. My family has been quarantined for 15 days and another family has been quarantined for 15 days. We've been self-isolating. Nobody is expressing any symptoms at this point in either. Can we hang out if we all agree that we're going to do?
Yeah, the recommendation is that you don't.
Okay.
It's a very good question. It's a fair question. Because most people aren't doing that. I can't say that. Let me take that back. It's a good question, and the recommendations would be no, that you should just continue to remain isolated and quarantined. But your point is otherwise well taken. But somebody who, you leave the house to go to the supermarket to pick up some food and stuff, and maybe you are asymptomatic and you have
right.
no family, you have no symptoms, and you have another family over for a social gathering, and you may transmit to somebody who then takes it home to grandma, and then grandma gets sick and dies. And so that's
it's literally got to be you've got to be 15 days out from leaving the house essentially and having nobody else come in.
Basically, yes. But even at that, and we are moving to that, Sam. I hate to say this, but this is going to last. This is a new normal that's going to be this way for a long time. I mean, this is going to happen for, I'm guesstimating 3 to 6 months,
right.
Lives are going to be disrupted like this.
And we don't know if we're going to get, one of the things about the 1918 pandemic that people forget is that there was actually like 3 or 4 waves. Like you had people dying
from
the 1918 pandemic in 1920.
Yeah, well, in 1919, but yes. Yeah, so there was three waves. There was the wave that happened in late 1917 and early 1918. Then there was a second wave that happened in late in the fall of 1918.
And that was the most deadly one.
That was the most deadly one. And then you had a third wave that happened in 1919. If there was something in 1920, I'm totally unaware of it, but I am familiar with those three waves. And let me just say that let me be very clear about this. That was the flu. This is right. The coronavirus. Influenza virus and coronaviruses are very different. So the influenza virus is likely to be subject to weather. Okay, it very likely is. And we're seeing the coronavirus circulating in countries that are humid or temperate or warm right now. So I don't think that weather may make a difference, but your point is otherwise well taken, that this may happen in waves and we just don't know. And certainly, had we kind of quote unquote opened for Easter, that was a humdinger. There would have been a second wave. That would have for sure happened. And it was, it's with some positive kind of solace there that I'm able to look and say, okay, well, at least now we're moving the needle to end of April. And I still hope that even, extends even further.
All right, Mark Allen, I want to take any more of your time, but let me just ask one more question if I could.
Sure.
The death rates and hospitalization rates of young people, of different cohorts from country to country. I think the death rate in Italy is much higher than it is in China or in the United States. Young people may be different in one country or another. Is that a function of just we don't have a controlled group of subjects? And to the extent that we do, I mean, do we have a control group? Are the people you're talking to looking at a city in China that is similar to a city in, I don't know, Georgia, that is similar to a city in Italy where, socioeconomic factors are more or less the same, where comorbidities is more or less the same? I mean, does that exist?
I think that that's going to exist when we do retrospective studies, when we look backwards, because the reason why we're seeing all these different mortality rates is largely due, and this is my opinion, is largely due to the testing situation. So because we don't have a good grasp on testing and we haven't tested everybody, you're seeing these wild fluctuations of mortality rate. So for example, if you look at the mortality rate of South Korea, they've done the best testing. They are the best example of testing that we're aware of, I'm aware of. And that mortality rate was 0.5. So that's maybe what the real, quote unquote, real mortality rate is, just because they've done so much testing. But to answer your question, which is a great one, Sam, is that it's in the retrospective study. So when they go through and they do the serology, when they measure antibodies, so what they may do is they may go to a city in China and they go to a city, let's say, in Georgia, and they're similar on multiple different levels. What they'll do is they'll go through and they'll test serology in a sample size in Georgia, and they'll test serology in a sample size in your example, let's say in China, and then they would be able to calculate mortality rates more accurately that way based on the sample of who had antibodies positive and who had antibodies negative. And a mortality rate is just basically the number of deaths divided by the number of people with the disease. And then at that point, you would be able to compare to see whether or not, in this case, that would be the S strain virus versus the L strain virus, going back to what we talked about, and were there different mortality rates with the S strain and the L strain? Well, I think we kind of know that the L strain probably has a little bit higher mortality rate. So that example, but let's use an example here in the U.S. With the city, like, let's take Milan, Italy versus, New Orleans, Louisiana, let's say, where the virus was the same. They would then go through, do a serology testing. They would be able to identify a baseline sample of who was truly positive. And then I think what you would see likely at that time is you would probably see matching mortality rates. I don't think that the mortality rates are going to be different. They're all over the place now, largely because right. We don't have a good denominator. But I think once we look retrospectively, I think that you are going to see that they're probably the same in healthcare systems that are more or less the same. In terms of young people, I don't think we know enough yet at that point. Okay. And so that's certainly something we're going to be looking for.
When I tell people, you know, at one point, because I think we're headed towards the mask thing. I mean, that's what I see some of the reporting with the CDCs. If they're doing a T-shirt mask, right, and they're doing a double layer of cotton, like, do they need to wash that after they go out? How long does it stay on the fabric? Does it stay? I mean, does it stay on the fabric long?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably 24 to 48 hours.
Okay.
And remember, the virus is the virus that the fabric is picking up on is going to very likely be where your mouth is on the inside of the fabric. But it's fair to go ahead and just wash it all. There's no question about that. After every usage, I would wash it. Absolutely.
Lastly, two-parter. Is there a site that you go to that you would recommend people to go to get solid information? Because I think for a lot of people, that's just been the hardest thing. It's just like, we don't know who to believe. And is there anything that you are worried about going forward that you see as a potential danger?
So what I go to is, I'm a physician, so I read medical journals. So the CIDRAP, CIDRAP, which is the Centers for Infectious Disease. I just forgot what it is. It's a great group out of the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
They have a really beautiful bibliography, but it's all medical literature. For people who are not, and then I would go to the JAMA or the New England, but those are all medical, journals. So for people who can read medical journals, those are the best sites. For folks that are otherwise not medical, aren't reading medical journals, the WHO website is excellent, and I think the CDC website is still excellent. I have a lot of colleagues that work there. I know that they're working really hard to try to get the best information out there. And then I will say this. I was just actually talking to a colleague as we were just driving. We were driving from one place to the other as we were going from office to office and, responding from fire to fire. CNN has been doing a great job. New York Times has been doing a great job. Washington Post has been doing a great job. I'm not one that really looks toward mainstream media for information, but I've been incredibly impressed with those three entities particularly have been doing a really, really good job of getting information out there.
Interesting.
In the last question, what am I particularly scared of? I am fearful that this is the beginning. I've kind of coined the term of COVID-22, the idea of being that we may see something like this again as climate change is forcing bats, particularly, out of their natural habitats, or as human beings dig deeper and deeper into parts of the world that they've never been into and are gathering these animals or getting more in touch with these fruit bat species that is where these coronaviruses are starting from. I see that we may be seeing something like this again. But the thing that really keeps me up at night is the possibility, and this is a political talk show, so I hope you don't mind if I talk politics for one quick second, that we've seen a little bit of a bump in the president's ratings, if you will. I am shocked that we haven't seen an opposing party standing on a pedestal, calling lie after lie. And I'm particularly frightened that this may help the current administration potentially get a second term, if you will. And that's particularly frightening. I just don't understand where the opposition is and why the political leaders aren't standing on pedestals demanding to see where's the test or you promised us this or half hour after they do their press conference. Why are we not seeing, a Pelosi or Schumer or Biden standing up and going over lie after lie and describing lie after lie, and having professionals there, known epidemiologists or known infectious disease doctors that can help kind of talk about that. And so that's the thing that I'm particularly frightened of more than anything else, because we have seen that this lack of centralized coordination, we have, just today, Governor Cuomo, who knew all of a sudden Governor Cuomo is now getting is a thing all of a sudden, right? But Governor Cuomo made a great a quote, or at least he's attributed to this quote this morning that I read, which was, it's like having 50 states bid on one ventilator on eBay.
Yep.
And I think that is such a great quote. You know, there was no centralized, if we look to government to be able to care for the health of people, I think what we're seeing more than anything else is a prioritization of capital over the prioritization of the health of the people. And that's what frightens me.
Mark Allen Derry, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I can't tell you how what a service it is to just be able to talk to you and get some clarity on questions that, you know, very, very hard to find out because of that lack of a source coming from the federal government, frankly, that is definitive. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Folks, if you were watching this live, you know that we had some problems with this episode. The internet broke again, and so our live show ended. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a break from our stream, and the fun half is going to be in the second half of the show today. Should just tell you our YouTube is a mess these days. The advertising is down. Views are down a little bit, but advertising is way, way down. So if you can support the show by becoming a member, please do head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. And we give you extra content every day. Try and do it live. We wait and see if the internet gods are being favorable to us. Mondays seem to be particularly difficult because people are at home working. But maybe by the end of the week, they start to drink and don't go on the internet as much for work purposes. So you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use your coupon code majority, get 10% off. They mail it directly to you. Great way to get your coffee, particularly in this situation, but it's also great tasting coffee. Also, don't forget, we got the AM Quickie. That is, you can get 7 minutes, 6 minutes every day, top headlines before 8 a.m. Check it out, amquickie.com. Check out the Noma Key Show over at patreon.com/the Noma Key Show, or you can go to youtube.com, Noma Key Const. Check it out there. Obviously, TMBS too. They will be live tomorrow night. Go to patreon.com/TMBS and The Antifada. Jamie's making new podcasts. Patreon.com/The Antifada. What do you got on tap, Matt, for Literary Hangover?
There's a brand new episode on Bacon's Rebellion. Check it out. On The Widow Ranter by Aphra Behn, a 1689 play. So check that out, folks. Patreon.com/Literary Hangover.
And apparently, your internet works when it comes to uploading that.
Yeah, apparently this stuff is going out nice and clean to everybody. So people who held on, good. Thanks for staying with us.
Very happy to hear that. That's great. It's quite a coincidence. It's a little your own disaster capitalism going on there. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Fun half. Look for it. It'll be the next video after this one in our feed. I think it'll be part two on April 6th. All right. Thanks for joining us. Stick with us. Be back in a minute.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly.